Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to Sentimental Garbage, the podcast where we talk about the chick lit that made us who we are. My name is Karen Dunhue and I'm a writer. I don't know her. Joining me is author and elusive chanteuse, O'Kanan Dalo. Today we're talking about The Meaning of Mariah Carey by Mariah Carey and Michaela Angela Davis. Hello, O'K.
Hello, thank you so much for having me. It's so nice to be
here.
I'm
so glad that we arrived on this book because you and I met at what I am currently describing as the only interesting thing that happened to me in 2020. So thank you for being a part of that, which was going to the Cheltenham Literary Festival. And we had a really good time talking about books and Drag Race. And then, as I often do when I meet other writers, asked you to be on this. And every single book you suggested, we had done already. And which is a lovely, lovely thing. Obviously, it's annoying when that happens because you want to talk about a book you both love. But the fact that we both love the same genre of trash was very warming to me.
I was like, Crazy Rich Asians, yes. No. Philippa Gregory, yes.
Oh, the Berlin no. Girl, yes. No. And then you suggested, and it was a genius suggestion, The Meaning of Mariah Carey by Mariah Carey. And I want to know what made you suggest that.
I think I've always kind of dimly been aware of Mariah Carey's like personal life, like, and gay Twitter was like on fire with this book as soon as it came out. So I was aware that it was released. And then I guess I kind of just put two and two together and thought this would be like a nice fit in terms of like, I mean, I didn't know what the content was going to be. I didn't know which areas of her life she was going to cover, but I thought, I feel like this is going to be quite a nice fit.
For yeah.
We're going to have a lot of stuff to say about
this. It's perfect. It's so lovely when somebody just understands the tone of this podcast immediately without hearing an episode and you just nailed it. I was like, yes. And I think what's also like interesting about this book as well is that aside over and above it being Mariah Carey, who's fascinating for many reasons, it was a real audiobook event. Like, so I think we both listened to this on audio and because Mariah knows her fans, or her lambs, as we are now affectionately calling
the lamely,
as we're calling ourselves. It's very much an audiobook with a lot of singing in it. It's very much Mariah being like, well, why would I have an audio format and not sing?
That was great. She added so much extra value. I was like, you suckers who read the book, you were fools. Like, this book needs to be listened to. Right, it's so good.
So how did that work for you? As in, like, with the first couple of times, it's so jarring because she's just reading about like her like relationship with her very violent brother, and then she'd be like,
yes. It was a bit surreal. I was like, oh. And then I was thinking, like, how much time has she spent in the studio on top of, like, the normal reading time? And, you know, what is the situation in terms of, like, has she had to, like, secure, like, rights for audiobooks on top of that? I just kept thinking of the nitty-gritty. But then I thought, you're right, like, after a while, it was like, actually, I can see this is a really nice touch. And I feel like, I mean, I said this to you when I was listening to it, but it really made me feel like she was talking directly to me.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And she says in the book several times how she has this relationship with her fans that's really direct. And, you know, she posted messages on her website before social media came along. But the whole singing thing really made me feel like I was getting like a private gig.
House, and I think because... You know? There's something about Mariah Carey's singing voice when she's not like fully like going for it, doing full ballad style or whatever. It's kind of whispery. Mm. It's like really powerful, but actually quite quiet in its own way. So it feels really like inside your ear. And it really, because I personally, like, I respect the value of divas and the pyramid of divas. Mm. More than anything else, more than religion,
yes,
certainly more than horoscopes. I just feel, I truly feel that everybody is born with a diva under a diva star. And it's sort of, it's very much the wand chooses the wizard, do you know what I mean? It just is part of who you are for your whole life. And I think with straight men, it's football players. It does the same thing. It's like outsized characters who are phenomenally good at being themselves, but also their chosen craft. And they, for some reason, represent your soul, but also they represent yourself to the nth degree. Like what you think you would be like if you were powerful and talented. Who is your diva?
Do you know, I think it is Mariah Carey. And I'm not sure that I realised it before I finished this audiobook. Like, I was like, so, I mean, I knew of her, obviously. She's like, who doesn't know about how talented she is and like the highlights of her career and stuff. But there was there were details about her life that I read in this book that sort of map onto mine in some like weird ways. Obviously, first of all, the singing capability.
You are mutantly talented.
Exactly. Like, I don't want to make it awkward. Like, so I'm just going to say that straight away. But like areas of like my childhood that I don't want to go into in too much detail, but like I related so much to the way that she grew up in terms of like her home life and how difficult that was and how she saw this career as like a way of escaping that and also of being herself. And I just thought, and then I thought, you know, thankfully I've never been in a relationship with anybody like Tommy Mottola, but you know, those men are everywhere. Like, those men really do exist, and they don't always have that much power and money and influence, but I've met men like that, and I'm sure that most people have come across men like that in some capacity. And I just thought, so much of this book, even if it wasn't stuff that I had experienced, I thought, I recognize that person, or I recognize that situation, or I know people who've been in that kind of relationship. And I just thought, she is me and I am her. We are the same.
You know? You really are in the Lamely.
I am, and I didn't even know.
So beautiful. It's like you're coming out all over again.
I know. I need to go out and beat up a Whitney Houston fan or something to like complete the initiation. But I'm well on the way.
So for me, my diva has always been Cher.
Interesting.
I think there's something, I don't know, just ever since I was really, really young, I saw her in Mermaids. And then I think when I was kind of coming of age as well, she was doing the whole Believe thing. And that was just really powerful and really everywhere. And because she's so strange looking, there's just something about her face that just like stapled onto my brain. And then one of the first sort of books that I, really soapy books that I got into as a young person was her autobiography. And just ever, and it's so funny because now Mariah, you've read Mariah's memoir, and now you belong to Mariah, and I belong to Cher because I happened to read her memoir really early, and now I just see Cher as being part of who I am.
That's so interesting, and I love that you love Mermaids as well. That was like one of my favorite films growing up. I just loved it, even though I was probably too young to watch it when I first did.
It's weird.
And I probably didn't understand what was going on.
Yeah, Mermaids has one of those. It's a very 90s visual palette where it's almost like a John Waters movie or something. Where or like Matilda. I've talked about Matilda before at Cheltenham, where it's like that sort of fluorescent suburban thing where the colours are very candy-ish. And it feels like a children's film, but actually it's about like teen pregnancy and God and mothering. And it's just done a lot, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's probably why it felt safe to watch as a child. In the, like, you know, kids tend to switch off if they think something is like too grown up for them in a boring way. And there was lots of stuff in there that I just couldn't access as a child. Like, I do not know what it's like to be a single mum and like having to constantly move around America. Yeah. But like, there's you're right, like the aesthetics of it sort of are quite well even if you don't know
even
what's
though it's
going
like
on.
Winona Ryder like going to a gynecologist to see if she has had sex yet, and he's like, nope.
I swear I did not understand that until like
exactly but that's the power of the diva. She is the anchor with which all complicated themes are rooted in, you know. Leah, Cher will be for maybe next time I could make you read Cher's memoir and we could talk about that.
We could try if this goes well. Team Mariah forever till I die. Cher who?
Cher. Well, indeed. Like, what is Cher's last name? No one's allowed to know. So I think, like, you know, usually I would do a plot summary, But because this is Mariah's life and people are aware of it, I think we should just work through her childhood chronologically and her life chronologically and just and go through it, really. So we begin with Mariah in this very specific way of growing up that I think a lot of not fans, but people who are not that aware of her aren't as aware that she is from a mixed race family. Her father is Black Venezuelan, her mother is an Irish American. And this is really the first impression that we get of Mariah's early life. And I think the conception of Mariah is very much, we're dimly aware that she's mixed race, but we don't know how much of a baggage it's been for her.
Yeah.
And I found that like really, really affecting. What in those early chapters stood out to you the most?
So there was that, definitely, because I was in exactly in that position. Like, I knew of Mariah's... I knew very, very vaguely that Mariah was not, like, white. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, people make jokes about it. Like, I saw the film Precious, which she refers to, where there's that joke they make at her appearance. Like, what, are you black? Are you white? Are you Puerto Rican?
Yeah,
are you? So I was aware of it from that. But I think the thing in the early chapters that most stood out for me was, like, just how chaotic her home life was. Like, I just couldn't... It was so... There was so much in it that was shocking. In like, you know, what her parents had been through, what she herself had been through, what her siblings put her through, even before she got famous and like they were taking advantage of her and stuff. It was like, my God, like to grow up in that incredibly confusing, violent place.
It's even like, confusing as like a reader because it's so... There's so many changes of like location and sort of combinations of people who are living with her. So so she's the youngest of these three kids that her mother has had with her father. And her oldest brother, Morgan, is like, that feels like quite an age difference. So he's like a teenager when she's quite small and he's already like really like violent and angry and acting out. And, you know, the cops are called to the house quite a lot, which is a very interesting bookend to the book, which I think we should get to when we get to it. And her sister is just sort of referred to as troubled throughout, and she ends up having an extremely dark life of being married very early, moving to the Philippines, coming back, and then sort of being a sex worker for a while, trying to get... I mean, it's quite loosely referred to. Mm-hmm. But yeah, tries to sort of pimp Mariah. It feels like a very young Mariah. But one of the very early bits, which kind of really broke my heart, was where Mariah says something like, you know, I've always really loved Christmas. And, you know, obviously that's what we associate. Mariah's kind of the queen of Christmas, right? If anybody is, like, she is Mrs. Claus.
Literally, like, there's that video online. I've done some of these. There's that video online of when she's talking to her kids, and one of her kids says, "Mommy, mommy, mommy." If you say, like, I can't remember if it's Amazon Echo or one of those things. And she says, if you say, like, into Amazon Echo, like, play the Queen of Christmas, Mariah Carey starts playing. Like, this is her power and influence.
She owns Christmas more than Christ.
She does. It's the true meaning.
The true
meaning
of Christmas is Mariah Carey playing with snow. Yeah. And there's this bit...
And being
fucking rich. There's this bit where she talks about, because her siblings, because they were troubled or whatever, were always living in some combination of being away with family, with her father. The parents split up when she was quite young. The only time that they would really be together as a family would be at Christmas. And because... all of this resentment would be banked throughout the year. It would just explode at Christmas, and they would sort of resent Mariah because she was the one who was consistently with their mother, and then the sort of it would bleed into this fact that Mariah's also the lightest skinned of all of them, and that bleeding and the mother who is quite bohemian and has rejected her very racist upbringing in order to marry her father. Also has this sort of predilection with whiteness that's throughout the book. It's so complicated and so upsetting.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. There was so much history that went into that. And I find that fascinating because I just think that is how families work. Like, you when you're little, you might see your parents as like mum and dad and that's it. And then the older you get, the more you see, you figure out that they've had their own childhoods and they've had... you know, their own sort of received wisdoms, which may be right or wrong, and all this stuff that pours into it. And then you're right, like when she talks about the pressure that is put on Christmas and how it was never what she was hoping it would be, I think so many people can relate to that. Even if you have a really lovely relationship with your family and what, you know, even if you have nothing like the problems that she's had, I think it's everybody puts a lot of pressure on Christmas and everybody wants it to be a certain thing, and it doesn't always live up to that because it can't always live up to that. You know, things go wrong and people get busy and, you know, things happen. I just thought, I feel like that was just so powerfully rendered, the way that she talked about how desperate she was to just have a normal, safe home life, and she never got it. It was just,
That's the thing about Christmas now, and we're like, today is the 4th of November, and we're kind of in the run-up to it, and everyone is already, like, settled on the idea of a miserable Christmas, and, you know, there's always this sort of sense of, there is so much pressure on that day for it to perform. And it's so interesting because Mariah now, because she is the queen of Christmas, her music is the thing that blares when we're all last minute shopping on Christmas Eve because we want tomorrow to be perfect. Like, it's so funny because she's contributed to this sort of like commercial thing of, oh, Christmas has to be perfect. And her herself grew up in this, why isn't my Christmas ever nice? You know, it's so...
Isn't that wild? And then, but then I think that also kind of makes sense, this idea that somebody to have that powerful an imagination about something, about Christmas, and to have such an intense vision for it, I think it does entirely make sense that that comes from experiences of deprivation and of chaos and separation. You know, I think maybe only somebody who has wanted that perfect Christmas so much and never had it can come up with such a pristine vision of it that most people just never achieve.
Because it's such a dream for her that it is sort of tinged with this otherworldliness. How do you feel in general? Because I feel like a bitch for saying this, but I don't read that many memoirs. I don't know about you, but I sort of hate reading about people's childhoods.
I don't read that many memoirs either, and I don't remember the last time I read a memoir that involved somebody's childhood, actually. I think I've read like one or two others that I can think of off the top of my head, but they were like Edmund White's City Boy, like where he talks about like when he was like a grown man in New York. So that's a very, very different type of thing. I can't think of a memoir that I've read of someone's childhood off the top of my head. It was difficult to read for me. I have to say, to listen to in some ways. I think partly because I'm a teacher and teachers, you know, we get this like, you have to do the sort of yearly update on like safeguarding, which essentially means listen to all these 10 different types of child abuse for like an hour and listen to what they look like and how to spot them and who you report them to and all that stuff. And it's always so depressing. Wow. And I think for anybody who like works with children, it's always going to be especially like, that's like horrible to know that kind of thing about, you know, someone's actual childhood. And so that was really, really difficult for me. And obviously because when she does escape that life, she then escapes it essentially into the arms of Tommy Mottola, who was problematic in his own way. That was just so, like, she has such a long road to like happiness and freedom.
You're so right. It really is. And like, there is like, so she leaves her childhood, which, for me, goes on a little long, but I would say that because I do feel like, I know you're a Mariah stan, so I won't be too critical, but I feel like when famous people recount their childhoods, there is a sense where they infuse everything with destiny. Things are creatively remembered, and some things that I listened to, I was just like, Mariah, that didn't happen. Like, people don't talk like that. People don't do that. And like,
I did wonder, because obviously she's co-written it with somebody, and I did wonder how much of the writing was done by which person. I would have loved to have been in the room when those discussions were being had. And I don't, do you know how ghostwriting works? Do you know anybody who's done it?
I know a little about it. So the ghostwriter on this one was a woman called Michelangela Davis, who is a writer for Essence magazine. I think that's what she's most known for. So it's a very, like, it's a like very interesting like selection, and I think it is just a series of interviews essentially. But I do know that most, I don't know. It's hard, isn't it? Because it doesn't seem very editorialized at all. It does seem like it's directly from the horse's mouth, as it were.
Yeah.
And, exactly. Yeah. So I think mostly it is a series of interviews and then the person looks over the manuscript. But this feels like maybe it was a series of interviews and then it was a Google Doc they both worked on and then it was...
Yeah.
Got the idea of Mariah Carey with Google Docs.
I love the idea of her just singing into my Google Doc dictate.
Can you imagine Michaela Angela Davis's like WhatsApps, just all voice notes? Just like.
But then your phone would have WhatsApp voice notes on it from Mariah Carey, and you would just never.
Yeah,
you
never.
Them. I would play them at Christmas parties. So, I would play them at bars.
The sonos. There she is. There's my girl Mariah.
I'm just going to play this little voice note that MC left me. Just a little quick thing.
So when she Charlotte goes on a little long for me, and then she moves to New York, and we get those great bits that I always love in any memoir, which is when someone's being poor but perfect, you know. When they're like, they're poor, but they're on their own, and they had a dollar a day, and they could either get the good bagels from H&H, or they could take the subway, and it was a choice every day.
That was wild. And like, while I can definitely believe that any woman in the spotlight, certainly in that time, would not eat very much, period, I was like, are you serious? Like,
a bagel a day.
Are you serious? A bagel a day, and she had to, and then she also talks about how she spends like hours in the studio, like doing, like recording and writing work and all this stuff. And how did you get through that without needing to eat any more than one bagel? How is that possible? Like, however, because she never looks unhealthily thin that I can remember from like publicity photos. Do you know what I mean? So you know what I mean. So that's one thing. But also, like, talking about her childhood and how it was remembered kind of imperfectly. I was like, what I want to know is like. How on earth did you get from recording like a little jingle as like a teenage side job to like signing $1 million contract?
Yes.
How does it go from one to the other? Like, yes, she talks about sort of some of the steps in between and how she was always really fascinated with music and she's always really, and you know, her mum went to Juilliard, which I think is also really interesting.
Yeah, so her mother is a trained opera singer.
Yeah. Which actually makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and so she does talk about always having the piano in the house and always singing and stuff. So it does make sense, and that her voice has been this thing that's been cultivated since she was, you know, very, very young. And she talks about as a teenager kind of doing demos for people and singing on people's things, and she's always mixing with musicians her entire life.
Yeah.
Which is really, that's a very interesting thing, and maybe you'll definitely know more about this as you are a teacher. But I've got a friend who's doing this mentorship program at the moment where she's sort of learning how to mentor people. Because I think it's something a lot of authors get asked to do, but nobody knows how to do it. And so the mentor program, I've said to her, like, the number one thing that holds people back isn't necessarily, like, money or class or this. It's not knowing people in those industries. And, like, you need to know someone who's even tangentially involved in that world, even if like you want to be a musician and you know somebody who records jingles for an advertising company, you know, it's knowing that there is an infrastructure, an industry, and that people like you go in and out of it is the most powerful thing. And I think for her, she's always surrounded by working musicians like her entire life, and so it seems very everything's sort of like, yeah, of course I'm going to do this. There's no real jump, you know, and that's so wonderful. There's no moment for Mariah where she's like, and I couldn't believe this man was interested in me. She's like, of course, I'm Mariah Carey.
I love that. I do love that. And, you know, she does say like a couple of times how she wants this story to be an inspiration to people, like young people. And, you know, I want you to always believe in yourself the way I always believed in myself. And she talks several times about how it's just through sheer talent and self-belief. And because she obviously has a lot of self-belief and a huge amount of talent, you can believe that. But it's just this, like, it just seems so wild that she made that journey from this like chaotic, really difficult home where there would have been 1,000 reasons for her not to succeed in any way to, okay, I've got $1 million contract now. And I'm on everyone's TV screens and everybody in the world knows who I am.
And also, I'm like 19 years old and I own all my own music.
Yeah.
That thing. There's this brilliant bit where she's like, she's signing her first deal, and she says, like, she happened to have seen a Beatles documentary where they referenced that they didn't own their own music because of licensing issues, and she's like, oh, that's never going to happen to me. I'm going to own all my own songs. And she sort of bargains for that at such a young age. It's incredible.
Yes. Yeah, when she wouldn't have had, say, certainly she wouldn't have had, like, parents in the room with her who would have been, like, completely on her side.
Yeah.
Like, you know, protecting her and you know, safeguarding her in that way. She seems to have had like a huge amount of intelligence at a very young age about this industry that a lot of people know nothing about.
Yeah, totally. And I think there's this, I think that brings us back to sort of the overall conception in the public eye and in the culture of who Mariah is. And I think, and something she gets at in her memoir quite a bit is, because she has this otherworldly voice that no one had ever really heard before, and it's just so notes no one had ever heard before. It's like almost, people have always treated her almost like a sideshow act rather than an artist. Like,
that's interesting.
I think people treat Mariah as if she is a person whose voice happened to her. She was given this gift randomly by the gods, and she has been using or misusing it ever since. There is very little consensus in the culture for her artistry, the way she writes, the way she produces, the choices she makes of who she works with. And I think there's a real defensiveness in this novel about that, because she talks more than anything else about the about production, who she's working with, and why she's working with them.
Yeah, you're right. And actually, you're 100% right. She talks a lot about, like, how she really emphasizes every time she talks about a song, I wrote this, I co-wrote this. Yeah. I remember the moment when I came up with that melody or that chorus. I spent hours in the studio learning to do this, that, and the other. And also when she talks about Aretha Franklin, that was really interesting.
Yeah.
That she talks about how Aretha, yes, she was this incredible singer. And I also sidebar, I love how she talks about how much respect Aretha had for
totally.
Her personally and for nobody else. but I love that she also says, she still doesn't think that Aretha Franklin is fully respected for how brilliant and a musician and arranger she was. And she says that, you know, when a woman is, I think she says especially a young woman, has a fantastic voice, people tend to ignore all other aspects of her ability and her musicianship and her skills. And I think that just really hits on what you're saying, and I think that's true.
I think there's always been this sense, particularly since, because and the phases of Mariah are very interesting, because when she was first sort of discovered, quote unquote, by Tommy Mottola, who was her first husband and the head of Sony Records, and the very controlling husband that we're about to get into, she was styled kind of almost like a Celine Dion. Like, it was a lot of like jumper dresses, and her hair was super curly.
Yes.
And like ballads, and just like the beautiful girl next door who has this amazing voice kind of thing. And she talks as well as like, they wanted to keep my hair sort of like curly and voluminous because it made me look a bit Italian rather than mixed race.
Yes.
Which is something I'd never even, looking at pictures, you're like, oh, I do see that. There is a kind of Marissa Tomei sort of look or something, or a Fran Drescher look that you're almost going towards.
Yeah. And just, long before these public conversations that we're now having about how political hair is, we've got books like Emma DeBeery's Don't Touch My Hair, and we've got this whole long conversation that is so important about straightening of hair and wearing afros and what is socially acceptable and what is deemed professional. And long before those conversations came out into the open, this incredibly famous woman was having such a massive degree of control imposed on her hair before I think most of her fans would have really had the vocabulary to discuss why that's even problematic.
Completely. And she doesn't even have the vocabulary in it. There's this really like powerful scene where during her marriage to Tommy, she sort of sneaks out to have dinner with people her own age, because she's always hanging around with older people, because he's so controlling about who she hangs out with and who she talks to. She goes out for like a dinner and people are talking about like passing and all these kinds of things. And she said it was like her brain blew open, because she'd never had these conversations before. She'd never really known anyone who was mixed race the way that she was. Everyone was just on either side of a color line and she never belonged. And it's really powerful for somebody like in their like mid-20s to be able to have these conversations for the first time, you know?
It was so wild, and you're right, that so much of her life was around people who, I mean, as we're going to talk about, I guess now, people who were controlled or paid or by Tommy. And that in itself is just this really horrible, creepy thing that you can just imagine being a very, like, insidious, like, part of her life that is A, kind of easy to get used to because it's quite, it's done in a very underhanded way, but also like incredibly damaging. But then you're right, when she talks about the liberation that she feels just about being able to talk to like young people about stuff that she is passionate about and not have somebody controlling what she's going to say or like answering for her or, you know, vetting her answers and stuff like that, it's just wild. And it just, I honestly really felt at that point that I was like rooting for her. And I think that is a really powerful part of the whole diva like franchise, isn't it? Like this idea that this incredibly distant person who has nothing to do with me, I find myself cheering for in the past tense, you know?
And like, you're like, go, like, you scrappy little underdog millionaire.
Exactly. Like, that's what is, I think, so powerful about this kind of memoir, is that it's like, you know how it ends. So you're just like desperate for it to end the way that it does.
It is so soothing. It is like sort of being a child and being told different versions of Cinderella over and over again and knowing the answer, but needing the struggle and needing to know that the struggle is fine because she got over it. Let's like park ourselves firmly in Tommy Mottola's camp.
Oof,
which I thought were, in terms of the writing of the book, the most interesting and also the most most frustrating. And then it became quite clear to me that the reasons that were frustrating were for legal reasons. Did that occur to you at all?
I was wondering throughout the whole thing, actually, what the legality situation was. Because, you know, she talks, like you said earlier, she talks about her sister, you know, kind of pimping her out. And she talks about her mother in lots of ways that are really clearly very unflattering, and the amounts of violence in her home, and then obviously Tommy, this incredibly powerful man. And I think she mentions at one point, does she, that she had like not an affair with somebody outside of her marriage, but like there was a guy that she met and there was a bit of a flirtation and stuff. And I just, the whole time I was just wondering, how on earth is she being given, like, how has her team of lawyers given her clearance to like say all this, like, and what legal battles are being fought or will be fought because she's said all sorts of things. And I did notice that the one time that she said something really explicitly, like, shocking about Tommy, the incident with a knife running down her cheek, was an incident for which there were lots
of witnesses. I was about to say that the and the Thanksgiving episode, the only time she is ever specific about what he does are when it's in public events where she knows there are people who can verify what she's saying, and therefore it isn't libel. And then everything that, like, in terms of their private life together, it's so like expertly done. It's all I feel statements. It's like, I felt, I felt. Because she can't say it. And I just kept thinking, how binding that must be. Because this Tommy Mottola is like a man in his 70s now, but he's still extremely powerful. He's still extremely rich. Yeah. Like, to have, like, to even when, and you can really tell throughout this writing process that this is something that she's enjoying doing. She's enjoying these conversations in Google Docs with Michaela. And she feels free, and she doesn't have these constraints of like a morning talk show to tell her story. She has all the paddock she could possibly want to tell the story, but she's still hemmed in by these Tommy Mottola fences, you know, like 20 years on.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Yeah, it's wild, and you're right, she does very, very cleverly do that, the whole I felt, I thought sort of thing. And yeah, there's nothing that there's nothing in there that is unverifiable except for her own sort of personal feelings. Although I did think one really great sort of like point she scored there was by talking about how she just never fancied him.
Oh my god, yes, there's nothing libelous about that, is there? She just yeah. never fancied him.
I was just like, wow. And there's nothing you can say to that. Like, she just didn't fancy you. She just didn't fancy you.
You're so right. That's so something that, like, you can destroy a man with, but he can't sue you.
Yeah, exactly.
He cannot sue you.
And I think she does sort of reflect on how she knows how it might have looked, like, externally, like, this, like, much younger, like, ingenue, this with this much older, not necessarily the most conventionally handsome,
but extremely powerful and well-connected.
Exactly. And then she talks about how, I think, is it the night before her wedding when her friends try and talk her out of it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That was like, they were like, if you want to go, you can just go. You don't have to marry him. And I just thought, that's so sad. Yeah. Like, you could have left then. And obviously there must have been something making her feel like she had to go through with it. But it's just like, wow. Imagine if she just...
But like, even the way he comes into her life is like, she's at some party, some very glamorous pop star party. And he locks eyes with her and says, who's your friend? To whoever she's with. Like, oh, this is Mariah. She's going to be a huge deal. He takes her demo tape, goes into his car to listen to it there and then. And then by the time he comes back, she's gone and he has to, like, track her down. So it does feel like almost like a movie kind of thing. And
it does.
And,
yeah.
like, she says that at that point, she's like, even then, I knew that Tommy Mottola was the bitter pill I would have to swallow to get through. Mm. And it's like, it's so calculated. It's like, well, this is what I want. And he likes it. So.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting how I think this happens so much with abuse stories where.
Mm.
The woman or the person who's being abused thinks initially that they're the person in control because they're being love bombed in this way, whereby they're getting so much attention. They're the object of their person's affections and their adoration. And Tommy thinks she's so talented. She's the most talented person he's ever met. And so she feels like the person who's in power because she's the person with all the talent. But then she doesn't kind of notice all these kind of gold gilded cages that are forming around her as she is this idol to him, you know?
Gosh, yeah, and she does talk, doesn't she, about how intense that whole courtship period was and how... And I think that is the only time in the whole book that I remember when she does sort of feel... Yes, you obviously, like you say, she's in control in a sense, but she's also... I think that's the only time I remember her saying that she feels, like, overwhelmed or, like, diminutive in comparison to somebody so powerful. Mm-hmm. She's like, oh, I didn't know who he was. Like, I just didn't know, like... you know, I didn't, this is like powerful man and he was interested in me and he listened to my demo tape and oh my goodness. And like, you know, she really makes it really clear how she felt like she was like this tiny little bird in his hands almost. And he was, and that's when that's the only moment in the whole book that I remember her saying like, I felt small in comparison to somebody else. Like I felt like, do you know what I mean?
Yes, exactly. And it goes through and there's this moment a couple of years after they're married and they have this huge sort of like Princess Diana inspired wedding and that she is very frank about, like, yeah, of course it was a publicity stunt. I wanted to be, yeah. How do you think I got to be Mariah Carey? Not without careful planning, my friends.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Which is another really interesting element of it, that she very like frankly admits some of the less flattering, less organic sides of her success.
Yeah.
Like, she's just like, yes, it is a production. You know, if you want, like, for example, when you're doing, like, a TV performance, like, you can't just turn up on stage and sing. You have to have this department. Yeah. You've got to have hair, makeup, cameras, lighting, all of this stuff. And and that was really interesting. And I think that how that, there's a really interesting dovetail with, like, how she talks about the performance of her wedding and how she talks over and over again about the time she spends in the studio and the mechanics of that. And how she's kind of used her intelligence for both.
Totally. She has got so much intuition about it. And obviously, this is very much like Mariah Carey is the last person who's going to say, I was wrong or my instincts were off or whatever. She's very much... Like, she does, to be fair to her now, to give her full credit, she does give a lot of love and attention and praise to the people who, you know, have brought her up along the way and the people she surrounds herself with and stuff. But she's always like, I knew this was where music was headed.
Yes, exactly. She really does, doesn't she? And when she talks about the Glitter film, which I actually haven't seen. Have you seen it? I actually have seen it.
I saw it when it came out in VHS. Like, I rented it with some friends. I thought it was fun, you know. But then I remember the jokes that happen after Glitter much more than I remember Glitter itself.
That's interesting.
And the thing about... So when the Glitter period happens, so she has this long marriage to Tommy that she eventually ends, but, like, it ends by degrees. There's no, like, big, like, you know, my name is Tina Turner kind of... There's no moment where she goes to a hotel with no money and tells them she's Tina Turner. It's like this sort of like thing where they go to therapy and the therapist slowly lets her know that this isn't normal, darling. This isn't...
It's not normal. It's brilliant. If you listen to the audiobook, listeners, treat yourself, because the way she does like accents, especially of that therapist, is just golden.
Yeah.
It's normal.
You're not dealing with the normal person. I was really in that room with her. And then they sort of have a trial separation, and then it slowly eases into divorce. But once it does, Tommy's sort of revenge on her is like really potent and really scary. And so it's the, but it's thing is, it's like Tommy's rage doesn't work in a vacuum, and the entire industry, whether it knows it or not, is sort of jumping to his rhythm, right? And so he sort of like suppresses her marketing, suppresses all these things. We get basically the origins of I Don't Know Her, really.
Yes.
Which I love.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about I Don't Know Her?
Oh, such a juicy story. So this is something that I knew like the bare bones of before I read the book. Like I'd seen this clip on YouTube where Mariah Carey is being interviewed by somebody who asks her what she thinks about several female pop stars in the way that people tend to do, I guess, with female pop stars to try and get them to say something bitchy and blah, blah, blah. And she says, and you know, they ask her about, I don't know, Beyonce. And she says, oh, she's, yeah, I love her. She's fantastic. Lovely person. And ask her about some other female pop star. And she says, oh yeah, I love her as well. And then they say, Jennifer Lopez. And she says, I don't know her. And she just gives this really lovely, like, sorry, never heard of it. It hasn't popped up on my radar. And then, of course, it turns out from the memoir that this is because... And I knew something to do with Tommy Mottola was in there, but it turns out from the memoir that this is because Mariah Carey, as part of the Glitter soundtrack, had written this song called Loverboy, which was, I think, the lead song on the album or something like that. And she wanted to use a sample from a song by the Yellow Magic Orchestra called Firecracker. And then apparently Tommy or Tommy's cronies got heard of this and convinced another artist, Jennifer Lopez, to use the same sample.
So the thing about the I Don't Know Her thing was that, if you think about it, it's the classiest response Mariah Carey could have possibly had, because while she admits that, like, yeah, this is probably just a woman who I don't know, who was caught up in the same industry that I was, and crucially, I don't know her, but, you know, so I can't say what her motivations were, but ultimately, whether or not she was a victim of the same system that I was a victim of, I don't have to like her. She was still complicit in this. So... fuck you.
Completely. Yeah, completely. That's a totally legitimate response. Like, I would have, if I had been in her shoes, I would have named her, for one thing. I would have been like, it was her. Her name is Jennifer Lopez. She lives at 22nd Street in New York City. And she screwed me up. Like, I would have been much less charitable. But yeah, so you're right. I think it was really, it just felt really like polished and like classy. And like, I'm not going to descend into like anything. Like, you know, I mean, I'm not going to descend into anything petty, but this happened. It was a professional situation in which she should have done something different, and it messed with me, and I don't like it, but I won. Like, but I won.
And the thing about Mariah that she's, and you can see this all over YouTube, there are so many like shade edits of Mariah Carey being a little bit bitchy, because with Mariah, she always has this level of like plausible deniability with all of her cattiness, where she's always like, she has this very sort of unbothered, very smooth, almost like somebody who's on antibiotics or something, like very placid, like, I don't know. You know, it's very that, and she'll be like that about anyone she has a problem with. She'd be like, well, you know.
Exactly. She just, I think she's just perfected this level of like, almost acting as though she lives in a completely different world to the rest of you hoes. Like, I don't have to care about anything. I'm here on Christmas Island counting my money, and I'm occasionally going to drop some shade, and if you know what I'm talking about, then that's fine. But if you don't, then... Yeah.
And I think that's why she's such, like... Mariah was so made for the gays, do you know what I mean? Yeah. Because she just gives you enough little tidbits. She's like, she like just throws a bone. She's like, here, make a meme out of this.
She knows, yes, exactly. Like, she gets social media maybe before, more than any other, certainly any other pop star of her generation. She just gets it. And she fits so well into it. You're right. There's like, so one of the side effects of my listening to this book has been like fueling my obsession with Mariah Carey on social media. So like, if you go into my Instagram, like explore tab, everything on there is like a Mariah Carey shade meme or a Mariah Carey performance from the 90s or some thing where she, or like some Mariah Carey thing from her like stories where she talks to the camera and then instead of ending the video, walks out of shot. That's a very Mariah Carey thing. She might just be like, goodbye. She'll walk out of the shop.
Okay, bye.
Somebody struggled these clips together. Just clips of Mariah Carey like waving goodbye to the camera and then walking out of shot, and then the camera turning off. There's like 10 of them in a row. It's brilliant. I love it.
I think it's, I think so, the what happens after Glitter, I think, goes a lot into the creation of that Mariah Carey personality that we know and love today. This kind of unbothered, slightly distant, sort of like, oh, there's a camera, okay, kind of thing. And I think it's what fuels people who don't like Mariah, their frustration with her, because
there
they feel...
people who don't like Mariah.
Oh, there are people. You should, yeah.
Who are people, these people? What are their names?
Where do they live? I do think people have a problem with Mariah. I think because she is so... It's any fucking woman who's aware of her own talent.
Yeah.
And aware of how much money she makes people. Aware of what she does for the infrastructure of the industry that she's in.
Yeah.
And they hate that she doesn't try to Jennifer Lawrence or Taylor Swift it at all. That she's just like, here on Christmas Island, counting my money. but after Glitter, after this like thing blows up in her face, and what I really appreciate about her saying about Glitter as well, and what I feel like when Glitter became a punchline, what nobody wanted to appreciate was that Glitter was an entirely self-aware project. It was a pop star movie, like Crossroads or like Burlesque or any other kind of movie like that, La Bamba. this is a genre of film. The Beatles did it, like, of like movies for young people who want to see their idol in a film and have fun, and it's glittery and, you know, full of color and life.
Exactly. That is Jennifer Lopez's entire film catalog.
Yeah. And every now and then she does something like Enough and we're all very proud of her, but you know,
I don't hate it.
I like it. But then people do this thing where, because Mariah has this sort of like fine glaze over her and she doesn't let people in, they assume that Mariah isn't self-aware and that Mariah takes herself extremely seriously and that Mariah thinks this is like an Oscar-winning performance in an Oscar-winning movie.
Yeah.
And they think by reviewing it as if she were meaning to do that and being mean about it is the way to like approach this art, and it's just so unfair.
I agree with that, and I think that, I mean, you see that happen from time to time with like any work of art that like tries like humor or like fun. I think it's always very easy to kind of like take it down and be like,
yes,
well, you might think this is brilliant, but actually if we hold it to this standard. Like, I've seen takedowns of Beyonce in a similar way. Like, I've seen, like, people talk about, oh, well, she's not exactly Mozart, is she? And it's like, well, A, she's better than Mozart. And B, she's... And B, like, not everything has to be held to... There's so many different ways in which something can be good and entertaining and fantastic and fun. Like, it doesn't have to be... And you're right, like, because she has that kind of, like... Because she doesn't do any of the tricks that we are used to seeing that are like, that Lady Gaga, for example, will do to be like, hi guys, I'm self-aware. Do you know the kind of the little like, just to let you know, wink, wink, like this is tongue in cheek. Like I'm not doing this as like, I'm not taking this too seriously. And I like that she doesn't do that. I like that she just does this kind of like balls to the wall. This is what I want to do. It's fun. If you don't like it, you don't like it. I like that she doesn't like cater to this demand that everybody, especially women who are like having fun in their careers, will like promise everybody and reassure us that she's self-aware. Like, why should she have to do that?
I really think it's the most debilitating thing that women, that people do to women artists, and I'm sure they do it to all kind of artists, but maybe I just notice it more with women, where they think that like, oh, her, this kind of silliness or this sort of tongue-in-cheekness or whatever that she's doing, that's not what it is. And they take it extremely literally and as her being a fool or something. And I think that's epitomized really well with the TRL story.
Yes.
Do you want to go into the TRL story?
So I'm still not entirely clear on what happened. And I did read or listen to this bit, but it was she was promoting Glitter. She was, and it was like a publicity stunt, is that correct? Like,
yes.
It was planned, it was scheduled, it was choreographed. It was not simply, oh, I turned up on TRL doing this, that, the other. But she basically like staged like, I guess, a takeover of TRL or like a walk-in where she was like taking off like one top to reveal another top. Is that correct? Like,
yes.
It was like taking off clothes to reveal more clothes. Like, it wasn't stripping. And it was like, but like the host didn't play along. And what's the host? Was it
Carson Daly?
Carson Daly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who was like, who acted as though she was like having some weird mental episode.
It's so weird. Did you watch it on YouTube?
No, I didn't. I need to watch it actually.
It is odd. And like she does preface it in the book by saying, look, Tommy's people were like, you know, completely, you know, tying my hands behind my back when it came to marketing of everything, and I felt like nobody was doing anything because everybody was so afraid of Tommy and going against him, so I felt like I had to take marketing into my own hands. So I arranged to go on TRL because it's a summer movie. I was going to bring an ice cream truck and hand them out in TRL, like a very like normal like publicity thing to do. If it's like, oh, look who's here, it's Mariah, she's got ice cream, see her movie. And like, it was quite last minute, not very planned, but it was planned. And then when she comes on this Glitter t-shirt, and then underneath it, there's a Supergirl shirt. And the entire time she's talking about this, she's like, I was so exhausted. Mm. Oh, I was trying to do everything I could to make this like movie work or whatever. And then the, like, everyone, like Carson Daly just keeps going, why are you here? It's so unprofessional. The unprofessionalism is too much. And it's just like him being like acting like she's, it's a thing where people treating a woman like she's mental, and then she seems even more mental.
Yeah.
It's just so annoying. And then it begins this sort of like glitter infused like post Tommy tailspin where her grasp on her mental health becomes so tenuous. And what's fascinating about this is like, and it's, I think obviously Mariah Carey is not a story for everyone to relate to, but I think what is relatable about it is, I think what happens with a lot of abuse narratives and a lot of addiction narratives, and maybe that's why those two things come together so frequently, is that when you only have one thing in your life to worry about, you kind of are almost protected by that infrastructure. So like, nobody expects anything from, say, somebody who's a heroin addict, because like, oh, don't rely on that person. You know what I mean? That's kind of it's all they care about. That's their entire world. Similarly, when somebody's in an emotionally or in mentally abusive marriage, and that person takes care of their entire life, even though it's incredibly negative, that's still an infrastructure that they're used to living in. And when that infrastructure goes away and is replaced by all these people around her who are half scared of her ex-husband, half trying to make a buck off of her, and she has no idea who to trust. Her family are fucking for the birds. And like, she, the only people she really trusts are her fellow artists, who they themselves are working with her, and they themselves have their own interests and stuff, even though she respects them. Yeah. And it's, you could, and like, there's these harrowing couple of chapters where it's like, she just wants to have a few days off so she can have a sleep.
Yeah.
And they keep calling her house. Like, her staff won't listen to her. They keep putting the calls through. They go, Mariah, where are you? Where's Mariah? Where's Mariah? A lot of money depending on you, Mariah. And she's kind of like, I've made you countless millions. I just need a break. Like, why is no one lobbying for my time off? Yeah. She checks herself into a hotel. They find her there. Her brother shows up. And because she's just so happy to see a familiar face, she sort of kind of falls into his arms. He then takes her back to her parents' house, her mom's house, which she built.
Yeah.
Her mom starts having a go at her. At this point, she's breaking down. And this is like actually the most like frightening part of the book, what I found anyway, where she's having a fight with her mother, and she keeps imitating her mother's voice.
Yeah.
And there's this thing her mother used to always say whenever they accuse, Mariah would accuse her of like bad behavior, being like, I did the best that I could. I did the best. And she just starts saying, I did the best that I could. I did the best over and over again, until her mom calls the police.
Which was
And then she's committed. Yeah.
I mean, you're right. It was so harrowing. And I think it was so harrowing because she really, you can tell, A, her memory of that night is obviously very clear, because it's just so, despite, yes, her being committed afterwards and having been subjected to God knows what after that, and during that experience of being committed, this has been so deeply embedded in her memory that she remembers that, which is actually unusual for, in my experience, for like big fights. When you have like big fights, especially with family members, it's like, you often don't remember a lot of what you said. Like, you just remember that feeling of being so angry and sad and whatever it might be. So for me, one of the things that made that so like moving was the fact that she remembered so much of it in so much detail. I thought that was clearly a really harrowing experience for you. If you can talk about that years later, like blow for blow.
It's so interesting, isn't it? And it's like, there was a lot of talk in the last few years about the sort of I Believe Women campaign, kind of. I don't know if it's tactless to call it a campaign, but you know what I'm talking about, of like taking women's sort of assault stories more seriously.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of like looking at stories and stuff, and like that thing of like, when people can recall extremely specific and virtually unimportant details in a really visceral, like, there's a whole bit where she's sort of like, there's no clean crockery in the house, so she's like washing a bowl so she can eat.
My God.
And it's so, and there's kind of that thing of like, obviously I have no way of telling that this is all true, but the feeling of truth that just radiates off of this is so real, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And just the kind of the randomness of some of the details, you're right, like the fact that she was doing the dishes when she was so exhausted. Like, did she say she hadn't slept for like a few days by this point?
Yeah, like, 5 days. She had more than 2 hours together.
That's just ridiculous. And then she talks, and like, yeah, you're right, when she's like, sort of repeating what she says to her mother, like, oh, I did the best I could. Like, that kind of like, the descent of that argument into just like mimicry and mocking. It just, yes, it's petty and blah, 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 but also that is very, very human. Once somebody's been put through that amount of stuff, I think, was just, and she very clearly outlines how there was nobody to look out for her in this situation, and that the people who should have been looking out for her were either having a go at her or trying to take advantage of her, or both. I think that's a point when she talks about her brother wanting to organise a hit on somebody.
Yes.
Isn't it? Yeah. Which is like, what part of your brain thought that this is what I need right now? Like, I need to sleep.
Oh my God, yes.
Like, what? Like, I can't remember now who he was.
Person who he's afraid knows too much about the family and the sister's prostitution and his violent past. Some person who he thinks might threaten to tell the press and ruin Mariah's career. He's like, oh, I have a way. I think I can get him to shut up, but give me $5,000 first. And she's just like, what?
Jesus. You feel
so awful for her.
Yeah, just so awful. Like, imagine being in a situation where, A, calling your own parents or your own family was a bad decision when you're stressed, and B, when you're so tired that you make that bad decision because you can't see straight.
I found that really
difficult, that bit.
It's so, and this thing as well of like, and the sort of book ending that I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, about her mother and her mother's comfort with the police, and how when her mother, who is white, feels uncomfortable or threatened, her first instinct will be to call the police, and she has no consensus over how that means different things for her children than it does for her. It really is so dark, and it's like, it's amazing how, and Mariah, like, to be fair to her, does this Michaela Davis, who wrote it with her, does this incredible, I think the mother is fleshed out in this incredibly complex way, where she does talk about, like, wow, she estranged herself from her entire racist family in order to be with this man, and then she's, like, putting her children in the way of racist harm so blithely, you know?
That was really, I thought that was a really impressive thing, to be able to present that portrait of somebody who's obviously done a lot of harm to her at a very young and vulnerable age, and then continuously through her life, who she now refers to as her ex-mother, actually.
Yeah, she refers to Pat.
Right? And there's this bit towards the end of the book where she talks about how she's had to kind of divorce herself from certain family members. To be able to give a complex and nuanced portrait of somebody like that, who's had that terrible influence on you, I thought that was, you know, props to her, because that must have been very, very difficult to do.
Yeah. God, love her, Mariah. She's good.
What can't she do?
What can't she do? I hope she listens to this. I feel like she does. I feel like it's not unlikely. I think she likes being understood by people who are clever like us. There's this one bit that really made me laugh, where she's talking about the sort of industry that's sort of swallowed her, and like how you do, and that's what I was kind of saying a minute ago, where it was like she's been so chewed up and spat out by the industry and by people around her, that of course she has this kind of glaze whenever we see her on like a talk show, this sort of detached thing where she's like, I'm not giving you cunts anything, you know? And I don't have to, because I'm Mariah. And she talks about meeting Princess Diana, and very, very briefly at like some party, and seeing, I actually wrote it down because I thought it was so good. She said, Princess Diana, and her eyes that were lit with the dull terror of never being left alone.
Oof.
And how they shared the feeling of always being surrounded by people, not all of whom want to hurt you, but all of whom want something.
Yes.
I was like, oh God, that's depressing.
That is depressing. And it was a very interesting sort of, again, another sort of interesting sort of dovetail moment, wasn't it? Of like these two incredibly famous, in their own different ways, brutalized women from that period. And I just thought, and then was it with Princess Diana where she talks about, imagine if things had been different, like imagine if,
imagine if Princess Diana would have had Twitter, wouldn't have life been better? I was like, really?
Okay. Not sure who signed off on that little phrase, but...
Yeah, it was so... that her, like, Mariah's whole view on social media is very interesting.
Yes. Because...
you go.
Yes. Well, I mean, I guess first of all, the fact that she ascribes social media that power to Princess Diana's life, perhaps retrospectively, is interesting because obviously with Prince Harry and Meghan, what's allowed them their kind of freedom, if you like, from the sort of royal family franchise has not been social media, but simply their very direct, I am not taking this bullshit anymore kind of response. But she does this whole social media thing. I don't know, like, for me, what's interesting is that she kind of gives herself a credit, which is maybe not unfair, actually, for having done social media before social media came along. Like, where she talks about that time when she was having that breakdown, when she was calling her fans directly and you know, she was sort of trying to talk to them directly. And then she says, well, people thought I was crazy. People thought I was this, that, and the other. But actually, I've been doing this on my website for a long time. I've been posting messages and they would respond. And I just think, but that's not the same. And it doesn't have to be the same.
That's not the same.
That's not the same. And it doesn't have to be the same. Like, I don't want to, this is going to sound really critical now, and I don't mean to, because I actually I feel like it's perfectly legitimate and fair and valid for her to just be having, for her to be doing all kinds of stuff which would, under normal circumstances, be considered irrational and weird, because she was going through some horrible stuff at the time. But what is interesting is that she kind of seems to sort of backdate her ability on social media to, like, the 1990s in that weird way, which she just doesn't need to. But then that is part of the whole project of this book, isn't it? Is where she feels like this is her chance to, especially with that horrible episode in her life where she was having that breakdown, this is her chance to sort of have that response and tell her side of the story in like a coherent, balanced way. So, yeah, I guess it was a little bit over the top, but I kind of don't, I'm not mad at it. Like,
I really enjoyed it. And, like, I do understand where she's coming from, because I think, you know, she's so used to having sort of tabloids recontextualize her activity, when now she can just, like, go on TikTok and be like, here I am, being normal in my fun home with my nice kids.
And
she's able to give a rounded portrait of who she is, and that must be, feel very liberating. And it's just quite rare to have any celebrity be like, I love Twitter.
Yes. And because actually Twitter is not, like, I'm on and off Twitter, especially off Twitter right now as the US election results are coming in, but I think that it is a skill.
Hey, maybe we'll get off this call and there'll be a new president.
Actually, I hope there's a new president and not the old one. And let's just leave it at that. But yeah, I think it is a skill. Like, some people are better at it than others, me, you know, and some people can use it and be really funny and brilliant. And obviously they have, like, helpers who share stuff and tweet for them and so on and so forth. But, like, some people are really good at it and some people are less good at it. And I think she's one of the better ones. I think that's a real skill. Yeah. Like, it's not easy to do.
I think as well, I think what's on Mariah's side is that she has she's a very, like, strong sense of the absurd.
Yeah.
And I think that always goes down well on social media, regardless of who you are. Yes. Whether you're Drill or Mariah Carey.
Yes. And she is very good at laughing at herself. Like, she doesn't do that whole self-referent thing, she doesn't, like, go over the top in the way that, say, Lady Gaga, for example, like I've said, will do to be ironic, to show people that she has a sense of humour. But she is also very good at laughing at herself, like the reference to Jennifer Lopez in this book, this woman who I don't know, and she just doesn't even have to hammer it, because she knows that every single person listening to that book knows who that is. And she does the same thing on Twitter as well, and on social media. She's just very good at kind of hyping herself up in that really clever way by referring to something that is just part of the culture that she's contributed, because everybody knows who she is.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. It does feel subtle. It's like she's the cutter's choice of divas. Like, subtle undertones here.
Yes. She's very interesting, isn't she? Like, if you compare her to somebody like Beyonce, who in many ways is the diva of my life forever. I can't choose. Like, Beyonce obviously keeps a lot of her stuff from view, and she doesn't let a lot of people behind that curtain, whereas Mariah Carey, she in a very different way kind of has given us this massive portrait of her life, which I can't imagine Beyonce ever really doing. And both choices are valid, but yeah, it's just a very interesting way of managing yourself.
You really can't imagine Beyonce phoning a fan, can you? She doesn't have to.
If she does, I really hope it's me.
Yeah. Hope it's me! That's so cute. Alright, we've been talking for a long time about Mariah Carey. It's time to talk about you.
Okay. This is my favourite part.
So your book, The Private Joys of Nina Maloney, has just come out in paperback. Such an exciting time for any author.
I'm cheap now. I always wanted to.
Ooh, she's cheap. I definitely felt when my paperback came out that it felt like finally legitimate. That is like, oh, they're really letting me do it.
Yeah. I know what you mean. You know,
do you like feel like similarly excited?
Yeah, it is really exciting because, well, I mean, it's the reason we met, essentially. The launch of my paperback was like the occasion that meant that I was invited to the Cheltenham Literature Festival, which is when we had that fantastic event together, which was so much fun. And it's kind of gives this book its whole second life. Like, I feel like most of the reviews, like, it's been through the whole reviews and prizes kind of cycle now. It's been a year since it came out in hardback, so all that stuff is kind of over, and now I can just enjoy like doing lovely stuff like this and going to events and talking to people about it, and it's like the whole like first publicity engine of it is like done, and it's this lovely second life of it, which is just great and leading to lots of fun things. It's really great.
Yeah, and you feel a bit more seasoned as well, and you feel like you know the things to talk about, and you're not going to just be like, well, I don't know, read it, I guess.
Literally, yeah. The first couple of interviews I think I gave were like, and you just kind of work your way into being able to talk about it fluently.
Can you give us a little plot summary?
Yeah, so it is about a teenage girl called Nena who is living in Manchester with her single mum, Joni. And Nena is half Nigerian, but her mother, Joni, is white. And Nena's never met her father, Morris, who is Nigerian. And there's a whole backstory behind that, that Nena tries to get out with her mother, but her mother really does not want to talk about it at all, which makes things very difficult for Nena and very uncomfortable. So the novel is really about the two of them learning about each other. It's about Nena's journey towards learning about her heritage and about her mother and what on earth happened between her parents in order to make things the way they are between them. And it's about their lives and their friends and lovers, and it's about all sorts of redemptions and journeys, really.
That sounds so great. And you know who would love that book? Mariah.
Okay. I'm not going to lie, the thought occurred to me as I was listening to the audiobook. I was like, you know what? I should have a little brown sand Mariah Carey little gift package.
Yeah. I think she'd like it.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine? I just, yeah. Oh, I can't.
Well, I hope she finds it, reads it, and endorses it, and then brings you on the next tour to do some just spoken word while she sings.
Up. Shut your
mouth. Imagine! I want that for you.
This has been Sentimental Garbage, and I've been Caroline O'Donoghue. You can follow me on Twitter at Zaroline, that's Czaroline, or email me about the podcast at ZarolineO'Donoghue@gmail.com. This has been a Justice for Dumb Women podcast. Thanks to Harry Harris for the jingle, Gavin Day for the logo, and Acast for the recording space.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.